This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Tuesday, 26th of October, 2021. Boy, this is an interesting session we're having in the U.S. yesterday. You could almost call this a kind of melt up, or at least it's getting to be on the verge of a melt up. The S&P closing quite strongly at another new high. Peter, you're pointing out that a significant portion of the gains was this incredible move in Tesla, a $1 trillion stock now. Elon Musk now worth more than ExxonMobil was the Bloomberg headline poll of the morning, I think. What's your take on all of this? It's pretty remarkable market we have here.
Yeah, we've gone in 2 weeks from talking about a potential inversion in the VIX forward curve, signaling potential flip in the equity sentiment. That didn't happen. We snapped back pretty dramatically, and here we are with the one of the steepest curves we've seen in 6 years in the VIX forward. And yesterday's Tesla, and there were two news. So the one news was what we have on slide three, which is that Panasonic has revealed this new prototype for a 4680 cell lithium battery, and that's for their more expensive cars because it, you know, those batteries have higher energy density. They can produce be produced at a lower cost, basically, and that's going back to the famous now famous battery day of Tesla. That is the path to win this market. So big deal for Panasonic there. CATL, which is the big Chinese battery producer, was also rising a lot yesterday because Tesla is saying that they're going to use their iron phosphate lithium batteries to all their standard cars. It has a lower energy density, but can be mass produced very easily at extremely low cost. And then you had the Hertz order for 100,000 EVs from Tesla. That combined just it flushed out all the short sellers in Tesla. You can see it on slide three. We went above 1,000, $1 trillion market value. Even Hertz was going up on this deal. I think Steen's remark on our internal call, I think, is correct. You know, I think Tesla is very much an idiosyncratic risk source inside the equity market. It's living in its own life. It resembles a little bit of what's going on with crypto. I mean, if you look at the current market value of Tesla, and you're looking at the future car market, the Cathie Wood interview we did, she said that they have upgraded their target for Tesla to capture 25% of the total global car market in the future, and that they have to do to justify these valuations. I want to just flag as well back to slide two, some of the best performers yesterday was crypto, but then green transformation, which that's where we have Tesla sitting, but then also in the battery segment was really doing well yesterday because of all these Panasonic and CATL news. So very, very positive sentiment in equities for now. And maybe, John, I know I'm talking a lot this morning, and then I'll shut up and talk about earnings later. But on slide four, the rising inflation expectations, these are the five-year inflation swaps on U.S. I think this is also a source of equity momentum. I'll try to explain it as quickly as possible. So with the five-year inflation rate at the current, around 2.6% level, a major breakout over the past 8 years, with the current yields you have in nominal bonds, that means that you're getting zero or you're getting negative expected real rate returns on your bonds. So I think as this inflation rate is pushing higher, expectations are pushing higher, I think it actually makes a lot of institutional investors increasing their weight into equities because that's the only way you can get a potentially positive expected return with rising inflation expectations.
Such a key point, because when you have these nominal yields, especially at the longer end of the curve, not doing anything, it just feeds this behavior and will continue to do so until there's something that snaps back the other way and real yields rise. And speaking of the five-year, I actually put up separately the European five-year, which has really accelerated quite remarkably in the last couple of weeks, especially over the last week. You can see that on slide seven. And that takes me to you, Christopher. We have a treat to have you in the studio with us today. Your look at the European economy here. I mean, we've had this huge energy crunch, this power shock. What are you seeing in the numbers here suggesting that we're at a risk of a real GDP slowdown in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, this is very clear. When we look at the latest business survey, we see that companies start to really freak out about higher cost, and especially what is very interesting. I was looking, I think it was last week, the business survey for France, and for the first time since, I think, the beginning of the pandemic, we start to see that business start to worry about higher salaries. And especially they are have a shortage of labor in the service sectors. So we see that all the situation, you remember a few months ago, everyone was telling us that economic activity would be very strong, very low inflation, or at least it would be temporary. But as a matter of fact, when I look at what business companies say, it's very clear that we are heading for slower economic activity, much higher inflationary pressure, obviously due to supply chain, but I think there will be also this fight for higher salaries in many countries. Obviously in France, it is kicking off quite fast because we have this election in 2022. But as a matter of fact, I think we will be very disappointing regarding the pace of economic activity in the Eurozone in the coming quarters and probably in 2022. This will be very challenging, especially for the European Central Bank. And I expect that they will lower their forecast quite soon.
And central banks not having the tools really to do anything about a supply constrained economy, those supply chains. It doesn't matter if you raise rates a little bit when your supply side constrained. Now you're here, you are French, and you're following the French election as a native. And it's really interesting as an outsider to observe a phenomenon. To me, there's so many ways. Of course, every nation is very, very different. But this phenomenon of Eric Zemmour, take us through what you think the odds are that, first of all, he flushes out Le Pen as a factor, and secondly, that he actually is a rival for Macron. And exactly when is the time frame of the election?
April 2022, the first round. So we are getting very close, and obviously we start to know more or less who will be the candidate for each party. We just need to find out the next candidate for the center-right party in December, but basically we know what will be the main candidates already. I think Eric Zemmour phenomenon is unexpected first, because I think like the first time he was, the first poll where he was, it was in June this summer, and he was at 7%. Nowadays, he's basically the second or third candidate behind Macron. He's, I think, the latest poll, he was at 16%, and Le Pen was slightly below Zemmour. What is interesting is I think the problem is mostly Le Pen. Le Pen, she has a very moderate stance on immigration nowadays, and especially on economics. So basically, she doesn't look to be very much anti-system, and the only real anti-system candidate is nowadays Zemmour. I mean, Mélenchon, that was the third man in the 2017 presidential election, does not matter anymore. I think it's at 10%. So the game will be between people that consider that globalization, liberal economy is a good thing for everyone. So they will vote for Macron, obviously. And we see as a very strong electoral base because it's at 26-27% in the first round. And the other one that are against globalization, against immigration, basically against more or less everything, they will probably vote for Zemmour. He's the only one real anti-system candidate.
The real anti-system. So Le Pen's big error is seeking toward the center, trying to become mainstream. Ironically, that's going to be what erodes her support.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is a pity. I think she should have been mainstream in 2017, because we saw that being against the Eurozone, for instance, was not a valid point in order to be elected. But as a matter of fact, nowadays, she tried to be the moderate, pragmatical, far-right candidate, but it doesn't fit for people that vote for her.
Right. Anti-system vote, so interesting. All right. Thanks for that update, and we'll see how those polls track, as well as we need to watch the German coalition. Too much to add that into the conversation today. We need to watch it, though. And we need an energy update, because yesterday we saw a pretty big rise in U.S. natural gas prices, while oil sort of rose to new highs, came back a little bit. What's pressuring the complex, at least natural gas higher in the U.S., when it didn't really do much, as far as I saw anyway, in Europe yesterday?
No, exactly. And it is just highlighting these kind of dislocated markets we have right now, but also the notoriously volatile time of year we're entering, especially in the U.S. Now we're getting off from the injection into the extraction season. And it was basically a weekend weather forecast that predicting colder weather as we into the early parts of November. So we've seen natural gas rise 14% since the close on Friday. And also with the energy crunch we're seeing here in Europe and in Asia, there are obviously expectations for very strong LNG exports over the coming months. And that's also adding some support. And just to highlight the fear in the market about shortages towards the end of this winter period, we just look at the March-April spread in natural gas next year. That's also called the widowmaker because it's notoriously volatile. Right now, the discount or the spread is 25%. So March is trading 25% higher than the April. That's just the indication of how tight the market potentially could be when we exit the with the net consumption season to the net injection season. But with the, as you mentioned, oil markets, relatively quiet day yesterday, even though we had a bit of a weak finish. We made new highs, 7-year high in oil. We in Brent, we just basically almost kissed the 2018 high. I think we fell 4 cents short of hitting that high, and since then we've come down. But you can argue that we may have a bit of a shooting star here on the chart. It's not potentially that strong, but at least we could potentially in the short term just have some consolidation and some profit taking. What could drive that? Maybe a renewed focus on the virus, but also EU-Iran nuclear talks, which are about to kick off this week. But we are not going to get away from the fact that these markets are tight. Just look at the slide 8 here. If you look at the inventory levels at Cushing, which is the delivery hub for WTI, it's continued to drop. Gasoline stocks are off the charts in terms of levels compared to recent years. So we are entering a winter with a very tight market outlook. So any setbacks in the short term really can only come from news about additional supply. And I think that supply could be Iran. So that's probably where we should keep our focus. But for now, the market is tight. You can also see that on the spread between the first and the second month in WTI, the backwardation is more than $1 right now. That is very elevated.
Wow. And I wonder when WTI eventually, looking at those supply and inventory levels, trades at a premium to Brent. That's been a long time since that happened, pre-shale, I guess.
Yeah, it is indeed. And historically, that's not unusual, but we haven't seen that for a number of years now.
Okay, I don't know where to pick up. Let's maybe round out the commodity space. Gold can't decide what it wants to do. It looked like it was rejected after the Powell comments, but then it popped back up above 1800 yesterday.
Indeed, and just as you talked about break even and real yields earlier, that is really where I think the focus right now, because we do have this broader market optimism, as Peter highlighted, with the stock markets going higher. We got the dollar, which is showing a little bit of strength here over the past 24 hours, but nevertheless, we're above 1800 in gold. But as you can see on the chart, nothing really to get excited about. We need to break, and we're on slide 9 here. You need to break 1835. That is still the key level. Also the downtrend from the highs we saw last year. Perhaps just keep an eye on silver. We have that now double top at 2486. We're not too far away from it. If we do break above that, that potentially could just add a little bit of a tailwind to gold. So, but for now, 1835, until we break that, it's not going to be that exciting.
All right. I can sense how patiently Peter is waiting on the down the line, and he'll continue to wait patiently. So round out the FX space. I think a really interesting day here, a key test for the Australian dollar and a little bit for the US dollar, more broadly speaking, which has been under pressure against these sort of more pro-cyclical currencies, a lot of currencies linked to commodities, et cetera. So we have that Aussie dollar. You can see this on slide 5, or pull up your Aussie dollar chart, sort of clearing that local pivot area, 74.75, or zero spot 74.75, and into the zone up to about 76, which was sort of the range low, you know, with a bit of slippage here and there. And the first part of this year until, and this is the key event, until that June FOMC meeting, that was the key event that saw the dollar, that switch of Fed focus and the sense that we're switching to a tightening regime, really, you know, gave the dollar a strong boost right around that time frame. So we have that. And plus we have a Australian CPI release up tonight, the Q3 CPI release, very influential, obviously, on how long the RBA can insist on its position that it doesn't see the conditions right for a rate hike until 2024. And I put up on that same slide, by the way, the 90-day or the short-term interest rate futures for the Australian for Australia, so-called 90-day bank bill, which suggests what the three-month rate will be out into the future. And you can see that the market is already front-running rate hikes as early as around the Q3 timeframe of next year. So already the market is saying, is telling us, the RBA, there's no way they're going to hold this this ability to keep off from rate rises, which they've linked to the need for higher wages before they pull the trigger. So a very interesting data point there. And again, the technical situation. And then finally on euro dollar, a different place, the euro and the yen, very weak here, even though US rates did nothing yesterday. And even though we have very strong risk sentiment, so you'd think the dollar is the superior safe haven, et cetera. So that was a disappointing day for those looking for that break higher. You can see on slide 6 in the various FX trend readings there as well. And I'll just cut it short there because we need to talk about earnings, Peter. Besides Tesla, we had the Facebook situation out yesterday. We had a great chat about that on the internal meeting. But I'll let you, if you want to discuss that, but also this tremendous number of earnings releases we have for the rest of the week, which some of which you highlighted yesterday.
Yeah, maybe if we start in Europe, we've had DSV, which we have highlighted on slide 10 in red, transportation giant or logistic giant, delivering almost $50 billion Danish kroner in Q3 revenue versus 40 billion expected, and almost a 10% positive beat on the bottom line. So very strong result. They're upgrading their outlook for the whole year. Novartis also beating on expectations. So we have had some pretty good start to the European earnings season. And then Facebook, you can see on the slide, I put in their quarterly result there. So Q3 numbers were the relief sort of on the headline numbers. Operating margin came in 1 percentage point lower than expected, but I think there was a sigh of relief from investors from this. But you can already see the outlook, the guidance for revenue from Facebook for Q4 was 31.5 to 34 billion, and that was against 34.8 billion. Consensus estimate as of yesterday. You can see on the screenshot there that consensus estimate is already down now to 34.3. So the market or analysts are not totally buying Facebook arguments, but the internal metrics, both a teen usage, which came out in these whistleblower papers yesterday in a Senate committee hearing, are really declining. Their pricing power, that's publicly available information, so impressions and pricing powers are falling for Facebook, and that's the same trend we're seeing from Google. Snapchat mentioned last week the pricing power also coming under pressure because they have more difficulties allocating more precisely their ads because of this change that Apple have done to allowing basically their ecosystem users to opt out of tracking. But I think the key, I have two more points on Facebook. So if you look at the screenshot, you can see that already from Q1, which will be the first real test on earnings because that's where the base is more normal. So the Q1 last year was a much more normal quarter. You can see Facebook revenue growth is slowing down 17% and then 14% in Q2 22. So I think fast forward, Facebook is turning into a much slower growth company, and they also slashed their CapEx spending for this year. Another sign that they're seeing this slowdown across the platforms. And then my final point is I think they were borderline doing something that is not within the rules of being a publicly listed company, because these rapidly declining teen usage numbers that the whistleblower paper shows is a key metric for investors to make predictions on where Facebook is going in the future. And Facebook have withheld that information for the public. So I think that's really something that will be frowned upon by investors. And then Facebook had this, they did a big splash that they are now creating this segmentation reporting for the virtual labs and the hardware business. But my point is that I think what investors really want is a segmentation down the line of the old Facebook platform and then Instagram and then the Messenger WhatsApp. So my final point, John, I've talked a lot, is that today's focus on NASDAQ 100 and the technology sector will be, of course, on Microsoft, Alphabet, and Visa. And given what we have seen so far, this from the earnings releases so far, I expect very strong numbers. And then we have that Southern Copper as sort of the joker today to watch because of that very strong copper market and its importance in the electrification of the global economy.
Yes, interesting indeed. And we'll watch for that. You need to watch as well on the macro calendar. A couple of interesting things to keep track of today, besides the Australian Q3 CPI up overnight tonight. In Asia, we have the U.S. consumer confidence, where we're watching it, it has shown a sympathetic drop. So directionally, it's moving the same way as the Michigan sentiment series, which showed, again, remarkably record lows, not record lows, but cycle lows that were below the lows we saw around the pandemic outbreak months last year. So there's that one. But as well, on this consumer confidence front, really interesting poll that I was listening to a podcast this morning that highlighted for me that was out last Thursday, but still, of course, relevant. A CNBC poll, talking about Biden's approval rating, which is also generally a good consumer confidence survey, if you will, because when you have a public that's widely not satisfied with the president, it suggests something's amiss. And we see that inflation now, this is very interesting, inflation is now tied with the coronavirus as the biggest concern for Americans, up 16 points from the prior survey. So now we're seeing inflation rating as the strongest concern and will quickly become the strongest one if it stays elevated and assuming the COVID case situation continues to slide as it has. So really curious to see what the spinoff or the spin is on this consumer confidence as well as the number itself. We have the new home sales. We have that August. It's very tardy. I mean, here we are almost in November and we have an August home price index series. 20% though expected on that one year on year. Just an incredible gain. And that will be a headache going forward because you just cannot have that pace of home price appreciation without some significant damage down the road. We've highlighted some other bits and pieces for the rest of the week. We'll rather than continue on, we'll just cut it off here. And we'll preview that fall budget tomorrow from the UK, as well as the Bank of Canada meeting, et cetera. Anyway, for today, thanks for joining. We'll be back tomorrow with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.